Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. We've made it through the holiday season, which came with an uptick in travel and large gatherings. And unsurprisingly, cases and hospitalizations went up around New Year's, both in Vermont and across the country, and in Canada, as we just heard. Now, on New Year's Eve, Vermont broke its one-day case record. And today, more than 1,700 new cases were reported. The Omicron variant is persistent, and it's taking its toll on Vermont's hospitals, schools, and families. Here to answer your questions about the variant and all other aspects of the pandemic is Vermont's Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Did you have a good holiday, Dr. Levine?
Yes, I did get some relaxation time in. Thank you.
Okay, that's good to hear. Now, as always, we're taking your calls. You can reach us at 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at Vermont Edition. Now, Dr. Levine, we just heard from a reporter in Montreal about the pandemic and the response in Quebec, and they're instituting a number of restrictions, like the closure of non-essential retail stores, a province-wide curfew. And I'm curious what you think of those safety measures, since they're so different than the response here in Vermont. Do you think Vermont should be doing the same?
Well, they're different than the response in Vermont, but keep in mind they're different than the response in the United States as a country, and everything that the president has stated in his frequent speeches on the topic. But when you look outside the United States, the issues of so-called lockdowns or more restrictions do seem to be more prevalent. We notice that Europe is going through a challenging time right now, along with Quebec, and many of those countries are doing similar things. But we're also finding countries who formerly used these kinds of high restriction environments have decided to back off from that. Places like New Zealand and Australia and some places in Asia. So I don't think you'll see there's much consensus on that for sure. But I will make the comment that if we were to learn something from Quebec, what they have just told us, at least the reporter that you were interviewing told us, is that as of today, at least, their healthcare system is at high risk. So they are running the risk of really exceeding the capacity of their healthcare system, which has not only severe consequences for those who present with COVID symptoms, but it has severe consequences for those who have any kind of healthcare problem, who need to access urgent and sophisticated care. So that's really the, again, what we've been telling people all along is that's really what we're looking at constantly. 1,700 cases indeed sounds astounding and certainly is a headline-grabbing number, but that's not the number we're really laser-focused on. We're focused on how are our hospitals doing? How is the healthcare system doing? Do we have enough people to care for people in our healthcare system? And do we have enough beds to provide to fill, if needs be, with patients who need to be hospitalized? So right now, I can say that in Vermont, we do not have that kind of a crisis. And that's why you're not seeing any rapid movement here or elsewhere in the country to these kinds of restrictions. But obviously, we'll have to watch that very closely as various regions of the country experience Omicron more and more.
Now, you brought up hospital capacity, and we have a couple questions for you about that. But first, let's go to the phones. Kathleen in Hinesburg, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Levine, thank you so much for helping us all during these pretty tough times. We appreciate your service. I'm an MRC nurse, and I've been giving vaccines since February. And I would have two questions. One is, why is it that we are not focusing on using high-quality masks in order to cut transmission and transmissibility? And why are we not having a mask mandate? And the second question is, what are our plans in the state for lots of Vermonters who are going to suffer from long COVID? And thank you very much again.
Now, Dr. Levine, let's focus on that first question about masks, cloth versus N95. Do you have any updated recommendations for what people should be wearing right now?
Yes, I do. Number one, I still fully believe that a mask is better than no mask. So when we're talking about being indoors in public places, a mask, anything you have accessible. But then number two, you might as well go with what will be most helpful for you. And we know with Omicron that a single layer cloth mask is probably not the primary defense mechanism, and that we should use either doubled up masks, use the combination of a cloth mask over a surgical mask, or if you have access to one and are so inclined, using a KN95 mask. That's been validated, if you will, and known to be effective. I say that because most of the ones that are now available are the genuine article that we want. But in an earlier part of the pandemic, there were counterfeit KN95s. So we have to just keep that in mind. So the KN95 is something that many people will find harder to wear for a longer period of time. And they'd much rather have something like the combination of the surgical and the cloth mask. But those are important lines of defense right now. Her other question had to do with...
Well, she asked about the mask mandate, that persistent question from 2021. I don't know if you want to address whether or not that's still on the table for a statewide mask mandate.
Yeah, it's really not on the table. Well, it's always on the table, so to speak. So if we got to those conditions that you were speaking about earlier with a state of emergency and a need to really accelerate all of the mitigation measures we were using, that would still be on the table. But it's certainly something right now that we're counting on the cooperation of Vermonters for. We've been very specific about saying that this is very strongly recommended, and any time in an indoor environment that puts you at risk.
Kathleen, thank you for your questions. Let's go now to Jessica in Colchester. Jessica, you're on the air.
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure. What's your question for Dr. Levine?
I have a question. As a mother of a 15-year-old that was vaccinated through the school, and that was greatly appreciated last summer, who is now considered not fully vaccinated because he is past his 6 months without a booster. I am wondering how quickly can we hope for boosters for the 16 and under children? I hear it was approved by the FDA yesterday. But what does that mean for us in Vermont, and how quickly can we get our kids fully vaccinated?
Yes, great question, Jessica. As you mentioned, the FDA just approved booster shots for children ages 12 to 15. They also shortened the waiting time between the primary series of the vaccine and the booster shot from 6 months to 5. Dr. Levine, what do we expect the rollout for those booster shots for older children to look like here?
Yeah, so just to modify the second thing you said, they only did that for the Pfizer booster interval.
Oh, thank you for the clarification.
Not for the others.
Okay.
And they actually did a third thing. They authorized a third primary series dose for the immunocompromised children ages 5 to 11. So this all happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow is the meeting of the so-called ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and that's what's advisory to the CDC. So though the FDA authorized these as part of their ability, their regulatory ability over such things like vaccines, we wait for ACIP and the CDC to come out with the final sort of rendition, which they usually do very quickly and usually is aligned with what the FDA has stated. But we'll have to see. But once that happens, not a lot should have to change in Vermont because we've already got such an incredible, well-oiled machine going when it comes to delivering vaccines to people of all ages and certainly to really pushing on the boosters in those who have been eligible for them now and pushing for the primary series in our youngest kids who are now eligible for that, and we've been pushing with that. So through combinations of community-based clinics, school-based clinics, the pharmacies, and the healthcare practitioners, specifically in this case in the pediatric realm, we've been actually doing this all along. So I don't think we're going to see a tremendous need to do a huge expansion in that. But obviously, we want to be very responsive to get these kids as boosted as they need to be. Again, our goal, the real milestone that we have in line here is making sure that kids remain in school for in-person education. So this should be yet another helpful part of that.
Now we have another question about boosters from Gloria in Sheldon. Gloria, you're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. Yes, my question, Dr. Levine, is this. My last, my second shot I received was on August of 28 of this year, 2021. And I've heard conflicting reports as to when I qualified for my booster. I called Kinney and I called Walgreens, and they both said, no, it would have to be exactly 6 months after the booster, but after the second shot, but I've been reading from other health experts, like one in Connecticut, who's telling people, well, no, you can go get one 3 or 4 months after. I do not have a compromised immune system. She made that comment. Saying that even if you don't have a compromised immune system, that you're eligible to get the booster. So am I eligible to get a booster?
Which vaccine did you get?
I got the Moderna.
You got the Moderna. Okay. So I'm doing some quick math. August 28th, so September, October, November, December. So you are going on four and a half months, a little over 4 months. Yeah, so right now, there is no authorization for you to get the vaccine at the interval that you're looking for. You are still considered fully vaccinated because you've gotten your primary series at this point in time. I don't know anything about your health history, but obviously there's a large list of conditions that are on the CDC website and are on our Vermont Department of Health website that you should make sure you examine to make sure if you fit or don't fit into those.
Now, we have a related question from Renata in Queechee. Renata is a grade school teacher who got vaccinated with J&J and got the booster, the J&J booster, before Thanksgiving. And they ask, is this adequate protection? Should I get an mRNA booster like Pfizer or Moderna to top off the protection?
So what I'm hearing from you is she probably got, in total, 2 doses of J&J?
Yes. I believe that's her situation.
Yeah, so that's a tough one because the J&J, she had the opportunity actually to do a mRNA booster after the first dose of J&J. So the answer is I would wait a little bit. Because this is very recent that she just got her second dose of J&J. It's practically a month or 5 weeks. So I would wait at this point in time because she will get some impact from having had this booster. And we need to let that sort of play itself out in her own immune system.
Now, I want to shift the conversation a little bit to testing, and we've gotten so many questions recently about access to rapid tests, which ones are the best, rapid versus PCR. But broadly, lots of parents in particular faced issues this week when they were asked to test their children before sending them back to school or childcare. And there has been this sense, at least here in Chittenden County, that it's pretty difficult right now to get a PCR test. So what is the state doing to increase access to both rapid tests and PCR tests?
So I think what we've seen most recently is the impact of, you know, two sequential holidays, you know, a week apart. where everybody was interested in testing and doing the right thing. And that's really wonderful news. Vermonters have been listening and paying attention and trying to do the best they can do to keep themselves, their families, their communities safe. So that is the good news. The bad news is, of course, they really were looking in extraordinary numbers for getting tests. Whether, and there were times that because of the contracts we have with the vendor that we have, that PCR tests weren't being done. So we came in and had access to rapid PCR tests as well as rapid antigen test kits to fill in those gaps. I think you're going to see things return now to a more standard operating procedure, if you will, where we're going to have all of our usual PCR testing available all the time, as it always is, except during those two holidays. And hopefully access to that will be fine. In addition, we are, as you pointed out, handed out over 40,000, 45,000 antigen test kits to the parents of students who were restarting school so that they could be tested at home before school started. We have a number of other initiatives going on in terms of procurement of antigen tests for Vermonters that they would not have to pay for, that the state would be able to provide. And we have a number of supply chains that we're working down and solidifying those. And then, of course, we have all the pharmacies who have had intermittent access to antigen tests, but through no fault of their own, they can only get what they can get. It sells out quickly, and then they restart their shelves and have more in an unpredictable fashion sometimes. So a lot of that's going to change because the holidays are no longer the issue for everybody. But I do realize that, you know, you look at 1,700 cases today, you know, some of that's going to reflect the rapid transmissibility of Omicron and the fact that this is the result of gatherings done, most likely not Christmas, because we saw that happen already, but most likely New Year's Eve and New Year's. So we're going to see continued need for people to access the testing system. And I think they'll find that it's going to be a lot easier than it was before the holidays. But I do recognize now, we just learned today from CDC that Omicron now makes up over 82% of the virus in the New England region. So it's pretty much taken over. That means there, yes, there is some Delta still around, but it's being continually outcompeted by the Omicron. And so having said that, I suspect there will be some current stresses on the system related to perhaps New Year's and then secondary transmissions to people after New Year's, just because of the timing that we're in right now. We've been able to be very flexible with our PCR testing apparatus. And so when we've needed to increase capacity there, we've been able to do that effectively. And just like when we encounter outbreaks, where it would be helpful to have the state come in and do some more pop-up testing because of the fact that there's more demand, you know, we've been able to flex to that as well.
Now, we're going to need to take a quick break soon, but before we do, let's go to Jen in Burlington with a question about testing. Jen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Levine. For an employer who requires either vaccination or, for unvaccinated people, weekly testing, what test and how often should an unvaccinated person who has contracted COVID be tested?
So an unvaccinated person who's already contracted it and resolved that illness?
Yes. So after their 10 days or 14 days of isolation, what test should they be providing to the employer?
So that person, by definition, should not get another PCR test for 90 days after their infection, because the risk is it's going to still be positive. Doesn't mean they are actively able to transmit infection, but the fact is there'll be residual viral particles that this test, being so sensitive, will pick up. in their nasal secretions. So we say don't do a test for 90 days after that. Obviously, if they become symptomatic, there needs to be investigation as to what their symptoms are from. And they could use other forms of testing for that.
Now, before the break, Dr. Levine, we were talking about testing, and we've gotten some specific questions about the nasal swabs. Now, some healthcare workers have reached out to VPR and said they had concerns about the nasal swabs used in COVID testing, specifically that the swabs for both rapid and for PCR tests are not as effective at picking up Omicron as the deeper nasal tests are. Now, one healthcare worker says they got a negative PCR test while feeling sick, only to seek out the deeper swab test, and they found out they were, in fact, COVID positive. So are you hearing this concern about the different types of nasal swab testing from the medical community?
I'm not hearing it about the specific types of the swab as much as just the concern that the test may not be as effective against Omicron. Hmm. But I can't quantitate that. And I believe that with the large amount of Omicron being detected, that we're probably catching most of what we need to be catching with those tests. The other option for the person who reported what you just stated is that they did not have a high enough viral load on their first test. And by the time they did their second one, I'm assuming they did this on different days, that test was positive by that point in time. I just don't know the specific circumstances of what they're talking about. But one of the ways we've gotten such incredible compliance with people wanting to get tested is the fact that it's relatively comfortable in the nasal swab test as opposed to the deeper nasal pharyngeal swab, which people were, you know, often referring to as brain biopsy. So I think if we want to maintain the compliance of the population and do the best we can for most people, we'll still stick with the nasal swab at this point in time. I just don't think we're going to be missing that much. And again, people should be staying home if sick, regardless. So the goal here, again, is not to be out in public. Even if their test came back negative for Omicron, they do have something infectious, and staying away from people would be the best track.
Now, a brain biopsy is a pretty accurate depiction of the experience I've had with some of those tests. it makes my face hurt to think about. Now, let's go to Susan in South Burlington. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Ordered some tests online, and they were left outside on my porch for between 1 to 3 hours. I'm looking at the boxes. One says store between 15 and 30 degrees centigrade. One says 2 to 30 degrees centigrade. Can I comfortably use these and believe the results?
Very Vermont-specific question, as the temperatures are supposed to hit the negatives this week. Dr. Levine, is there any concern around storage of these tests?
You know, funny you should ask that, because that has come up just this week as a concern, that we're trying to find out a little more from the manufacturers themselves. The reality is tests do get stored outside. You know, there are times that we have people coming through drive-thrus to pick up these antigen tests, and they're out there for a short period of time. Then they get into somebody's car, and then whatever happens, happens. My hope is that this temperature measurement that was referred to by the caller is time dependent, so that hopefully one has a little bit of luxury of time, and that it's being extra cautious so that people try to optimize the likelihood that this test will come back with an accurate result. I do think we do have this concern in Vermont, so it's a theoretical concern. We're trying to learn more now as to how much of a real practical concern it should be or not. So I can't give you a final answer on that just yet.
All right, well, we'll stay tuned for updates on the cold weather and how they affect tests. Let's go to Woody in Charlotte. Woody, you're on the air. What's your question?
Yes, Dr. Levine. We run a after-school private program for children, and we have kids that are out, and they're asking when they can come back. So the only guidance I see is on the public school form, where they wait so many days, and if they're asymptomatic, they can return with no negative test required. Usually our private requirements are your recommendations. Our insurance companies don't like us just going with the recommendations. They want us to do, you know, the full Monty. So I'm not sure what it is at this point. Could you inform me what it is, what you recommend, and what you require?
These are kids who had COVID-19?
Yes.
And what ages are they?
Well, this is the thing. Some of us, they're all fully vaccinated because they're over 5. And then we have another program where all the children are not fully vaccinated. It's mixed at different times. We don't share those two groups together. They're separated.
Ah, okay. Have you looked at our most recent guidance that we just came out with?
Yes, it says 11 days if no symptoms, no fever over the last 24 hours. And then it says it is recommended that you have 2 negative tests within 24 hours of each other before you return. There's a requirement and a recommendation.
That's right. So right now, we have listed it as a recommendation. It's stricter than the CDC test, which has no test, you know, attached to it. The CDC basically said, if you've actually had to stay home and isolate, that's normally a 10-day period. You can change that to 5 days if your symptoms have improved, you had no fever, and you wear a mask around others for the succeeding 5 days. We said we didn't feel that was protective enough and added 2 antigen tests performed 24 hours apart, usually day 4 and then day 5. And then you can test out, so to speak. We didn't require that, but we strongly recommend that that be part of the process. We are having more discussions regarding school children as well, because the CDC's initial guidance did not apply to everyone. They listed it as general population. It did not supersede the guidance that came out for healthcare workers, which still stood on its own. And they stated that it did not include schools, child cares, long-term cares, etc. So that is still pending, because they came out with their original guidance in a fairly abrupt fashion, if I could say it that way. So we are continuing to put everyone into that category right now, but we're having active discussions about the school-age children. But for now, I've given you the way we've listed it for the purpose you have right now.
Thank you for your call, Woody. And related to that, we just got a tweet from Lizzie Ellen, who says, what data do you have on case rates for kids under the age of 5 that makes you feel it's not a priority to include early childhood centers in distributing rapid tests?
Oh, I'm glad this question was asked, because there's nothing farther from the truth that this is not a priority.
Mm-hmm.
This is a true priority, this age group, and we sincerely want the entire childcare sector to know that, and have communicated it to many who've asked, and to remain a very important component of our basic response to COVID and allowing people to have high quality childcare while at the same time keeping older children in schools, keeping parents at work, et cetera. So this is really important. The only thing that was limiting it until this point in time is really the supply chain for the rapid tests. We have actually been doing the planning for this since early in December. And all we needed to make sure of is that we had the adequate supply chain before we came out with the actual program for the childcare sector. As you know, we just really handed out the 45,000 or so test kits to the school-age children, and have an equal number that are going to the schools, as well as all the supplies the schools need for the test to stay. So we couldn't compromise that program by any means, and we just were waiting for the moment when we could actually be assured of having these antigen supply chain to help with the child cares. So that day is coming very soon, and I would certainly be, I would think, within the next week, 2 weeks maximum, that we would be able to unveil that entire program. So please stay tuned and be optimistic about that, because we sincerely want that to happen as expeditiously as possible.
So that's might be something that we hear about next week during the governor's press conference when those are back on regularly scheduled Tuesdays?
Yes, you'll hear about it regardless at the press conference. Hopefully you hear about it that it's happened already, as opposed to a date when it will happen.
Now, our colleague Jane Lindholm is live tweeting today's show. Hi, Jane. And she says there are lots of questions out there about why people are showing symptoms, kind of your classic COVID-19 symptoms, but they're still testing negative on rapid tests days and days after their symptoms begin. So Dr. Levine, what do you think is happening here? Are people's immune systems reacting to the virus before the test can catch it? Or, you know, do people have colds and the flu?
There's so many questions to ask because question one would be, reality is, what test is testing negative? Is it an antigen test? Is it a PCR test? Because we would hope the PCR test, being the most sensitive, will be testing positive if the person truly has Omicron. Second thing is, if an antigen test came back negative early on, would it be a false negative because it's a less sensitive test that could easily be rectified by doing further antigen tests a day or two later, or by doing a PCR test. So that's one important distinction. The other thing is the illness truly Omicron? You know, we are in wintertime respiratory virus season. We're not seeing a lot of influenza, so hopefully it's not influenza, but certainly we see lots of common colds and rhinovirus. And is that the problem? That's actually a different virus and not the same one that everybody's testing for.
Now, we only have about a minute left here, but we did get a question from a listener named Deborah about treatment for immunocompromised people. She says there are some new treatments approved in early December. Can you summarize what those might be?
Yes. The main one that I'm sure is being referred to is called Evusheld, which is a mouthful, E-V-U-S-H-E-L-D. And it's a long-acting monoclonal antibody that's given intramuscularly, so a shot in the arm, in the muscle, that would actually protect the person over the succeeding months from getting Omicron. So it's a preventive, if I could say that. And it's meant for people who are immunocompromised, who for some reason could only get one dose of the vaccine or have a contraindication to getting the vaccine, so that it's really ideal for that population. And it had a very high efficacy rate, over 70% reduction in risk of developing symptomatic COVID. So again, if anyone fits in that group, it could be a person who has cancer and is getting treatment for cancer. It could be a person who's on a drug that suppresses their immune system. They should be talking with their healthcare provider, because we're just starting to get that into the state now.
All right, Dr. Levine, thank you so much for your time. We have lots more questions for you. We'll have to save them till next week. Thanks again for joining the show.
Thank you, as always. It's been a pleasure.